This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Israel's massacre of unarmed Palestinians has once again shocked the sensibilities of the world. Unless, of course, you are a U.S. Democrat or Republican, in which case, whatever Israel does is fine with you. And the Move 9 have been imprisoned for nearly 40 years, but the struggle to free them continues. But first, Reverend Edward Pinckney, the activist from Benton Harbor, Michigan, was exonerated this month of election tampering charges that had put him in prison for 2.5 years. Reverend Pinckney is back pursuing his old nemesis, the Whirlpool Corporation, which has dominated the poor Black town for decades. Reverend Pinckney is set to disrupt Whirlpool's pet project, the local PGA Senior Golf Tournament.
The first thing we're going to do, we're going to call it Occupy the PGA. We're going to make sure they understand it's no longer business as usual. For years, they have not paid any taxes to the city of Benton Harbor. And they get the TV rights that comes in for the PGA, and that's a lot of money. They get a lot of money from the TV itself, and they don't leave any money here when they leave here. So we're demanding 25% of the revenue that's coming into the city of Benton Harbor for the senior PGA. And we're going to make sure that they understand we're going to be blocking the roads, and we're going to be doing everything we can to get them angry and upset. And it's going to be a few people getting arrested. But the point is, what we want to do, we want to make sure they understand that we're serious and we need that money for our city. We're sick and tired of being taken advantage of by Whirlpool and their little group, Robert Shore, the Jack Nicklaus signature golf course. They even surrounded the golf course with these $500,000 homes, and they won't pay taxes. Somehow they got my Black brothers and sisters to sign some kind of lease that won't allow them to pay taxes until 2022.
And yet Benton Harbor is a very poor and overwhelmingly Black community.
Absolutely. It's 92% African Americans, and we have more, over 60% of the people living here live below the poverty level. And unemployment is over 60% here. So we're fighting a real challenge here. And what's even more important, somebody got to take a stand against these corporations. Because what they're doing to the people of Benton Harbor, they're sucking the life out of them. And they don't even know which way is up now. During the week, we just opened up our center, the Benton Harbor Black Economy Network Community Organization Art and Culture Community Center. And it was a big success. We're going to start doing our electrician classes starting on May 24th. So all that tied into the PGA, because we want to make sure that they understand that business is no longer as usual. And we want to make sure that they understand that we're not planning on sitting down, because we're going to pick it and boycott until we get some kind of result from them.
Well, Benton Harbor is a company town. Whirlpool has dominated the politics of that city forever, which means Whirlpool has a lot of Black folks who do its bidding there.
Oh, absolutely. The elected officials, not only on the school board, but also the commissioners of the city government. And it's shameful and it's disgraceful the way they sell the people out for a few pennies. They don't give them enough for them to live extremely comfortable. They give them just enough to tease them. They give them lunch every now and then with the vice president of Whirlpool, and that's a big deal to these folks. These Black folks, sometimes, if you never have done anything in your life, you don't know nothing in your life, this is a big thing to you. So this is what we get as Black folks. We got to change the way we're doing business. We need to make sure they understand how important it is that we stand up for the future of our children.
And in fact, your latest stretch of incarceration is directly related to the fight against Whirlpool and the folks that it politically controls in Benton Harbor. You were trying to recall some politicians.
Absolutely. We were trying to recall the mayor, and we got twice the number of signatures we needed, and that scared the corporation Whirlpool here. That put them on notice that we could do anything we want to do. And at any time, see, and we did it in less than 30 days. We went out and got more than double the amount of signatures we needed. And that put fear in them. So Pinckney had to go. That was the whole thing. Reverend Pinckney, you got to go because that is too much power for a man in this community. More power than the elected officials. They don't control the people here.
But now Reverend Pinckney is back, and so are the protests at the PGA.
They always think that, you know, if they get rid of Pinckney, it'll stop the movement. Pinckney is just one figure in this movement. The movement will continue with or without Reverend Pinckney, and we have made plans to make sure it will. We are established here, and what we're doing now, we have a office now where we're stationary, and it's right downtown, which is beautiful. We're going to demand that they give us 25% of the profit, which is the most important thing. We're going to demand that they stop pumping water out of the Pawpaw River for fee-free and start using Benton Harbor water. They had attempted to steal Benton Harbor water, and the pipe busted. And when the pipe busted, it exposed them as stealing water. So they got mad because we wouldn't allow them to continue to steal the water, and they stopped pumping it out of the Pawpaw River, which they steal from the people. So we're demanding that you stop pumping water out of the Pawpaw River. And number three, we're demanding that you start paying taxes. We want you to pay your fair share of taxes. We're not asking you to give us no bonus, no nothing. We want our fair share. You use our roads, you use our city, everything you use, you don't pay any taxes. We want you to start paying taxes. And we're demanding it. We're not asking it. You know, we're demanding that you do this.
And we're going to see some civil disobedience.
Oh, without a doubt, without a doubt. Matter of fact, it's going to be chaos. We already got a plan. We already got a woman who wants a streak. So we're going to see that. So we're going to see how that works out. But I don't want to see her actually do it because that could be a serious offense, but she want to do it. So let's see what happens. And here's another thing. We're going to fly kikes over the golf course, and that should be pretty hilarious. We're talking about maybe 100 kikes will be flown over the golf course.
Throw them off their game, so to speak.
Absolutely. That's the whole game plan. So we're going to throw them off their feet. And whatever they're thinking, it won't happen because we're going to make sure of that. We're going to do what needs to be done because it's time that we start speaking up and taking back what really belongs to us.
That was Reverend Edward Pinckney speaking from Benton Harbor, Michigan. Israel has once again shocked the world, methodically slaughtering Palestinian demonstrators in Gaza. Scores of Palestinians have been killed by Israeli snipers, and literally hundreds more wounded and maimed, as they demanded the right to return to their ancestral lands that were seized by the apartheid Zionist state. We spoke with journalist and educator Vijay Prashad and asked him what the Gaza massacres show about Israel.
It reveals that the Israeli state has put itself into the position where it can do nothing other than shoot innocent people who are marching within their rights and peacefully towards a border fence, which has basically suffocated them for at least the past 11 years. The question to ask is, what other than this could the Israelis have done? And I think the answer is nothing. Because, as I said, they put themselves in this position. Israel is no longer willing to negotiate honestly with the Palestinians about anything that could resemble a two-state solution. I mean, effectively, Israel has ended the two-state solution by now absorbing very large parts of the West Bank and absorbing East Jerusalem.
And for the Israelis, that is the solution.
Well, this is exactly the issue. I mean, by taking control over parts of what was supposed to be the 1967 region of Palestine, they have indeed made the two-state solution impossible. Now, because Israel is founded on the principle of Zionism, it will not permit a one-state solution, in other words, giving Palestinians full civil rights, human rights, you know, the right to vote, the right to have the same position as regarding property and so on. Because all of this is not available to the Palestinians, the one-state solution is also off the table. If you remove a one-state solution, if you remove a two-state solution, what you're left essentially with is permanent apartheid in the West Bank, inside Israel, in East Jerusalem, against the diaspora Palestinians. And you have this huge prison, 2 million Palestinians inside the prison known as Gaza. And this is a permanent condition. In other words, Israel has basically suggested to the world it is an apartheid state, and any challenge to it is going to be met by lethal force. There is really no other option for Israel at this time to deal with a large nonviolent protest other than massacring people. We should really come to terms with that. This is not something that happened which is, you know, should be horrifying. In fact, it's not this event that's horrifying. It's Israel currently that is horrifying.
And yet here in the United States, we are not allowed, it is not considered polite political language to refer to Israel as an apartheid state. And since the 1980s, the international community at the United Nations does not refer to Zionism as racism.
Well, very interesting that you raised the UN resolution on Zionism as racism, which was passed in the 1970s and then reversed in the 1990s. You know, it actually is a very good example of how the United Nations General Assembly is to a great extent governed by the balance of forces in the world. With the collapse of the Soviet Union and the United States in the 1990s feeling like it was the only power, they were able to push against that resolution and have it reversed. But in recent years, the issue of apartheid has had, I think, very serious place inside the United Nations. The UN Economic and Social Commission of West Asia, based in Beirut, Lebanon, has produced at least 3 documents where they have looked seriously at the question of the concept of apartheid and the reality of Israel. And they find, you know, by having a studious, methodical analysis of the situation today, that Israel is indeed an apartheid state. And in fact, the former head of the UN Economic and Social Commission, Rima Khalaf, is now setting up an organization whose express purpose is to amplify this idea that Israel is an apartheid state. I think there's appetite for this conversation, and I don't think that the United States government or substantial sectors of U.S. society will be able to block this conversation.
Well, certainly the Trump administration has removed whatever distance had existed between the U.S. and Israel.
Well, yes, and in that sense, I think the Trump administration, as with so many other matters, has done a service to humanity because they have finally removed what I think had been a kind of fraudulent facade where the American government pretended to be a neutral actor in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, when the United States government was never a neutral actor. And as well, the Trump administration has removed the facade that the United States is concerned about the human suffering of the Palestinians under occupation. He has removed these two facades. There is no need now to have any kind of illusion that the United States is acting either neutrally or is concerned about the Palestinian people. You know, we are under no illusions any longer. And I think that actually should open up space to have a serious conversation about the United States, about Israel, and about the question of apartheid.
In Syria, the United States seems even more dependent on Israel now that its jihadist proxy fighters are on the bad foot militarily there.
Well, yes, you know, you're quite right that Israel has been attempting to shift the tide, at least in southern Syria, where the Israeli military has been bombing facilities inside Syria, perhaps to try to degrade the Syrian military. But this has also not really been that successful, because after all, the Israelis found that after a couple of strikes, there was retaliation. And, you know, there hasn't really been any retaliation from Syria against Israeli strikes since before 1967. But Syria has been quite willing to allow the Israelis to bomb inside the country and hasn't come back against the Israelis. There was a very dramatic incident several years ago when Israel bombed a facility claiming it was a facility producing weapons of mass destruction, and the Syrians did nothing. Well, now the Syrians are confident enough to retaliate. Plus, the Israelis know full well that the Lebanese political formation and its military wing, Hezbollah, are capable of inflicting quite serious damage on Israel. So even though Israel has been flying in and bombing occasionally inside Syria, I think there's a recognition among the Israeli armed forces that if they escalate this kind of violence inside Syria, the cost that Israel is going to pay will be quite high.
Of course, the United States has not hesitated to take military action against the Syrian Arab army on occasion.
Yes, the United States has indeed bombed inside Syria, has bombed Syrian government troops. But again, it's really quite interesting. Before September 2015, that is, before the Russian Air Force intervened in quite serious force into Syria, before the Russians came in, there was always the sense that the United States might launch a full-scale attack, not on, you know, the occasional relatively isolated military base, but on Damascus, on military and civilian infrastructure. And so in the fall of 2013, there was an expectation that Obama was going to launch a very serious attack. That didn't happen. But by after September 2015, after the Russian entry, it is now inconceivable to imagine the Americans launching anything other than a theatrical strike, which is exactly what Trump has done twice. He's launched two theatrical strikes at relatively isolated military installations in response to a big media drumbeat about what is happening in Syria. There is really no understanding, firm understanding in the United States about the developments in Syria. I think there's a very limited understanding of what's happening. And the American government, in order to perhaps portray itself as continuing to have some humanitarian sensibilities, on occasion does these theatrical bombing runs. But these are meaningless. They show that the West has got very little purchase in West Asia. And, you know, we should actually see them for what they are, which is not to be exaggerated, seen as theatrical, and basically ineffectual.
Yet the United States is entrenched with 5,000 or more troops in Deir ez-Zor province and a wide swath of Syria, in alliance in many places with Kurdish forces.
Well, you know, I think the Kurdish fighters and the Kurdish political community have understood that the United States is indeed a very fickle ally, a very fickle friend. Because when the Turkish government, late last year and early this year, decided to enter Syria to essentially punish the Kurds and prevent them from creating a contiguous zone along the Turkish-Syrian border, a kind of western Kurdistan, what is called Rojava, when the Turkish intervention happened, the United States did nothing. There was no public condemnation of the intervention, and the aerial force that has been used by the Kurds against ISIS, you know, the Kurds rely upon American air power. There was no air power to defend the Kurds when the Turks entered. So this alliance is a very one-sided alliance. And at some point, the Kurds will have to recognize that even though they have very few cards on the table, to pick up the American card might be really a long-term, even a medium-term error. For the question of the U.S. troops in eastern Syria, there's been actually a loss in territory. For instance, the United States had a base in southeastern Syria along a road that connects Beirut to Tehran. Essentially, it allows the Iranians to resupply their allies, including Hezbollah, by road and not by air. And the U.S. had a base, you know, right on that road on the Iraq-Syria border. But they've been chased out of that base and have had to go north towards where the Kurds are. So U.S. control over sections of Syria is indeed shrinking. And I think, again, it's not what it once was. And I think that that ability of the United States to remain there in the long term is going to be extraordinarily compromised. The new government that is going to come in Iraq after the May 12th election will not be as close to the Americans and will likely not allow the United States to use its roads to resupply any bases in eastern Syria. And since the Turks have already shied away from letting the Americans free access to Syria, if the Iraqis also, you know, cut back down on them, I don't think it's going to be easy for them to have access to those bases.
Yes, in Iraq, the party that gained the most leverage was the Sadrist party, which back during the U.S. occupation led to armed struggles against that occupation.
Well, the Sadrist movement, which emerged in force in 2004 and 2005 against the U.S. occupation, is now in an alliance with the Iraqi Communist Party and with the Iraqi Republican Party. And the three of them are essentially committed to an Iraqi nationalist politics. They are neither that keen on allowing Iranian influence to be too great in Iraq, but nor do they want American influence to be too great. And I think this is going to include allowing the Americans to support their bases in eastern Syria. After all, the U.S. bases are currently being supported by road from Iraq, and I don't think that's going to remain for very long.
So the U.S. position in Syria is, at least politically, growing untenable.
I think that within the year, we're going to see a serious problem come for the Americans. Yes, they could build a massive airfield in eastern Syria and resupply themselves through that airfield. But I think even that is going to be, people are going to scratch their heads and wonder, what's the point of remaining in eastern Syria? I mean, after all, there really isn't that huge amount of oil as there is in the Gulf or other parts of the world. It's quite clear that the Syrian government is going to, at some point, take control of most of western Syria and might move towards eastern Syria. It's also quite correct that the Kurds are no longer going to be able to have any kind of national ambition. At most, they'll have autonomy within Syria. If you put all these things together, you'd wonder who is going to allow the United States to maintain a base in eastern Syria. I think this is basically already an anachronism, which is going to come to terms with reality by the end of the year.
But the al-Qaeda and allied forces are still entrenched in Idlib province. There are many thousands of them, and those are effectively proxies of the United States as well.
Well, you know, in what the Assad government has been doing has been that over the course of the past 3 years, when they've been overwhelming their opponents, they've basically given them an option. Either you get on a bus and go to Idlib, or you stay here and we're going to kill you. And very many hundreds of people, now up to the thousands, have moved to Idlib, which has become, in a sense, the last redoubt of the Al-Qaeda-type forces. They're sitting there waiting. They know that the Syrian army is going to come for them. Now, for a period of time, it had been quite clear that the Turkish government had said no massacre in Idlib, no entry into Idlib. Essentially, the Turks had sent in and put in place surveillance monitors inside Idlib to prevent, to trigger warning if the Syrian army enters the area. And, you know, Idlib is not far from the Turkish border. The Turks had positioned troops there to enter and defend Idlib. And what has happened, it seems to me, what people are saying in the region, including in the Turkish government, is that this last summer, basically a deal was cut that the government in Damascus allowed the Turks to enter Syria to basically slice off the possibility of a Kurdish state being created in northern Syria. And at the same time, the Turks have said that in time, they will allow the Syrian army to enter untrammeled into Idlib. Well, we'll have to see if this agreement is going to hold, but it's likely that if not this year, early next year, the Syrian army is going to move into Idlib, and we'll see what happens there. You know, will they then tell the people, the 1,000 people, odd fighters, we'll give you passage to, say, the Sinai Peninsula. You can be Egypt's problem now. Or we're going to move you to Chechnya. Or we're going to just fight and everybody surrenders. We don't know exactly how this is going to play out. I think what's going to happen is they're going to say, we're going to send you all to Libya.
And, of course, one would never say that out loud.
Well, we have to face the facts that when the Turkish government opened the border, huge numbers of Libyans, Tunisians, even Algerians left North Africa and entered Syria via Turkey. And the reason I say, you know, we really have to talk about this is to wonder, how did they do this? How were they able to enter Syria? These ragtag fighters from very poor parts of North Africa. Somebody obviously brought them. And I think, I know that Seymour Hersh has talked about the rat line and has suggested that the CIA was actively involved. Okay, let's look into this carefully. I think there should be hearings in the United States. If not done by the Congress, which is mute, then people should open this conversation. You know, it needs to be wondered, how did these people get there? Was the U.S. government involved? I mean, it's certainly clear that through Operation Sycamore, the U.S. government was buying arms in Czechoslovakia and providing them into Turkey to be given to these people. Well, if they were certainly bringing arms into Turkey to provide for this war in Syria, perhaps they brought people as well. I think there needs to be public discussion about this.
So that the Turks and the CIA would put the rat line in reverse in motion.
Well, this is what I think. I mean, as I said, we'd have to see what happens when the Syrian army moves to Idlib. But I have a feeling that the Syrian army will work out a deal with the Turks and say, here we go. Here's 1,000 fighters. We put them on the bus. We're sending them across the border to Turkey. You don't want them. You're going to put them on a charter flight and you're going to fly them off to, you know, a small airport somewhere in, perhaps in southern Libya, in Sabah or somewhere. They land in the desert, throw them off there, and these chaps then join Al-Qaeda of the Maghreb, which, you know, as I can tell you, is mainly not a jihadi organization. It mainly is a cigarette smuggling racket. And these fellows get into cigarette smuggling and, you know, some of them become hardcore jihadis, but they sort of disappear into that part of Africa which is being essentially destroyed by the French and the Americans, that belt of the Sahel. And so I feel like this is probably the kind of thing that the Syrians will negotiate with the Turks. They don't want to kill thousands of people. You know, I don't think the Syrian government right now wants to have the repeat of Hama, the massacre of tens of thousands of people in Hama in 1982. They don't want a repeat of that. When that happened in 82, there was no social media. I think now they're just going to put them on a bus and send them to Turkey.
That was educator and journalist Vijay Prashad. Protesters have been trying in vain to stop the Philadelphia Orchestra from going on a trip to Israel. Susan Abulhawa is with the Philly Don't Orchestrate Apartheid Coalition.
The orchestra is planning a trip to Israel, expressly in celebration of what they're calling their Independence Day, which is also the Palestinian Nakba, when 80% of the indigenous population was violently driven out of their homes. And part of the trip itinerary includes visits with various known racist Israeli ministers. I'm not sure that anything other than racist ministers actually exist in Israel, but this particular one is very racist. She said that black asylum seekers, she said they weren't human. She compared the black asylum seekers to cancer. And then she later issued an apology to cancer patients for the association with black people. She's made horrible comments about Palestinians as well. She filmed herself at a Israeli football game where they were chanting genocidal chants against Palestinians. So she's a terrible person. And the orchestra's itinerary included a dinner with her. There are multiple visits with the Israeli military, including a meeting with an Israeli general, a meeting with an Israeli military reporter, and also a master class and performance with Israeli musicians. All the while, of course, we know what the Israeli military is doing to Palestinians in Gaza at the moment. Just wholesale slaughter. 12,000 people hit with live bullets, all of them unarmed and defenseless against Israeli death technology.
Yes, in light of these massacres by Israeli snipers, and it's been going on for days and days and days, has there been any reaction, any rethinking by the Philadelphia Orchestra of its trip to Israel?
Not that we're aware of. In the midst of this campaign, so initially we started with a letter trying to give them the benefit of the doubt, appealing to their conscience, thinking maybe they just don't know. The letter was signed by over 100 personalities, activists, scholars, musicians, and so forth, and 35 social justice organizations, including Philly BDS, Black Lives Matter, Real Justice Coalition, Workers World, Black and Brown Workers Coalition, and a whole lot more. And they responded with a very patronizing letter that was replete with microaggressive language, quite frankly. And it sounded, honestly, it sounded like they didn't even write it. It sounded like it was written by the Jewish Federation, which is sponsoring this whole trip to the tune of $2 million. So we, again, reached out to them, reiterating our desire to meet, and they didn't even give us the time of day for our meeting. So it became clear that they knew exactly what they were doing. And we took to the streets after that, and we've had a weekly sustained protest ever since then. We had a large protest on Monday as well, so we had, this will be actually, it's our seventh week, but it will be our eighth protest. We're planning, hopefully, a large gathering, which will also include iftar, because it's Ramadan. For those who are fasting, we're going to feed folks. It's stunning that art and music is being used in the service of fascism, of slaughter, of white supremacy, and all these horrible things that Israel is, as far as I'm concerned.
Is the Philadelphia Orchestra a publicly subsidized, in any form, operation?
Thank you for asking. That it actually is. I mean, it receives money from both private and public institutions.
And so would local government officials, for example, have anything to say about your complaints?
You know, we actually haven't tried that route. One of the things we considered was to reach out to sponsors, especially institutional sponsors. But, you know, our local government in Philadelphia, Mayor Kenney just recently raised the Israeli flag, actually just on Monday, in celebration of Israel. So it's quite demoralizing, actually, to see how many people in power are so subservient to this foreign government that's slaughtering people in broad daylight and for everybody to see.
Have any of your protests coincided with major performances by the orchestra?
Yeah, every one of our protests, with the exception of the one on Monday, coincided with a concert. So, in fact, we gather an hour and a half before the start of a concert, and we stay about half an hour, you know, after it started when everybody's inside. And so all the patrons coming into the concerts have to go through us. They have to go through our protests in order to get there. We've been spit on. We've been attacked. We've been verbally assaulted, physically assaulted. We've had people come up and try and snatch the microphones from us. There was an IDF soldier, actually, who I guess he lives in Philadelphia now, who came up to me at one point, and I was holding a poster, and I just put the poster up in his face to kind of, you know, as a wall between us. I'm a small, short woman, and he was quite physically imposing, so I just put the poster in front of myself, and he, you know, just very violently snatched it, and the cops were all standing around, did nothing, and it was only after the crowd sort of gathered around him that the cops moved in to basically, I guess, protect this guy.
Oh, this is the character of the patrons of the Philadelphia Orchestra. None of them were empathetic to your cause?
No, that's not true. There were some people who came through and said, you know, we agree with you. But of course, I'm not sure if they do anything or if they've actually contacted or expressed their concern to the orchestra. There were people who were just quite curious, who wanted to know what was going on and took some of our flyers. There were a lot of people who took flyers. You know, the ones we remember are the ones who assaulted us. There was one couple who came out and just, you know, stood in the middle and joined us. It was quite lovely. That was one time. I think it was on our first day. There was an elderly woman. I actually ended up writing an essay about this experience. She looked like she's well into her 90s, was walking with a walker. And I smiled at her as the way you do when you see someone so vulnerable, physically vulnerable. When she got to me, she said, you know, I just want you to know that I fought for Israel years ago against all these terrorists. And she was pointing to the photos of the martyrs that we had on the scroll. Those are some of the folks who patron the orchestra. And we don't want to let this go. I certainly don't. I think that maybe they're counting on this blowing over, but I think they think that they're underestimating the pain that we feel and the anger that we feel seeing so many Palestinians just slaughtered like vermin. They have no sense of our humanity, and our lives really mean nothing to them, but they mean a lot to us. Every person who was killed had a life and a family and people who loved them.
Susan Abulhawa of the Philly Don't Orchestrate Apartheid Coalition. President Donald Trump delighted the Israeli regime by recognizing Jerusalem as the apartheid state's capital in clear violation of international law. But Black Agenda Report's Bruce Dixon says the Democrats are just as guilty of coddling the Israelis as the Republicans.
Gruesome as the latest Israeli atrocities are, with over 70 murdered and a couple thousand civilians deliberately shot by IDF snipers, it will not be the turning point in relations between the U.S. empire and its Israeli client state. The brutal military campaigns against Gaza in 2009 and 2014 killed thousands, wounded tens of thousands, and displaced hundreds of thousands of Palestinians with a Democrat in the White House. Despite some DSA victories in western Pennsylvania, despite demurrals from Bernie Sanders and a handful of House members, and whatever qualms Democratic voters might have, Democratic Party leaders are, as always, firmly behind their Israeli clients, and their party machinery remains under lock and key. Even as Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump cut the ribbon opening the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, and hundreds of Palestinians were being gunned down, Democratic Senate leader Chuck Schumer declared that the latest provocation was long overdue and affirmed it as the official policy of both U.S. ruling class parties. California Senator Kamala Harris, widely considered her party's front runner for the 2020 presidential nomination, addressed AIPAC publicly in 2017 and privately this year. In 2017, she embraced the settler myth that Israel, quote, made the desert bloom, unquote, bragging that she helped by collecting funds to plant trees on the sites of massacres and dispossessions. No fewer than 24 states have enacted bipartisan legislation to publicly identify and blacklist individuals or corporations that do business with individuals and entities publicly named as BDS-friendly. Similar legislation has been introduced in more than a dozen other states and in the U.S. Senate. Israel trains thousands of U.S. police each year for hundreds of local departments, from big cities, universities, and state-level cop shops to small towns and rural counties. It's no wonder that U.S. corporate news media portrayed the latest Israeli massacre as a bizarre act of self-defense at Israel's borders, as though the gun line around the world's largest concentration camp, population 2 million, were an international frontier. The connection between both U.S. ruling parties and the settler state of Israel is bone deep and organic, though it may not be especially popular among rank-and-file Democrats. Most tellingly, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which traditionally pre-selects congressional candidates for loyalty to corporate power and empire, and funnels tens of millions per election cycle to the most right-wing Democrats it can find, is sponsoring no fewer than 40 candidates with State Department, Homeland Security, and military intelligence backgrounds in the 2018 Democratic primaries across the country. Among the leftmost Democrat elected and selected leaders are Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and North Carolina's Reverend William Barber, the anointed heir of Dr. King and head of the New Poor People's Campaign. Both Sanders and Barber call for a two-state solution to the Israel-Palestine horror, as if 40 years of facts on the ground, from the apartheid wall to the land, sea, and air blockades of Gaza, and the network of Jewish-only roads, encroaching settlements, and military checkpoints did not exist, and as if Israel did not control the electric and water grids even the aquifers beneath Gaza and the fishing rights offshore, as if Israel didn't issue the paychecks of Palestinian civil servants and determine the budgets of Palestinian government agencies. When Bernie and Barbara bray about a two-state solution, nobody ever asked them out loud why the racist ethnocracy of Israel must be preserved in their imaginary construction as a neighbor to Palestine. It's just something Democrats are committed to. There is no land and no resources out of which to make a viable Palestinian state. The Israelis have taken or blockaded everything of value except the humans living there. Governments based on race and ethnocracy have no legitimacy in the modern world, except among U.S. Democrats and Republicans, themselves heir to a nation built with stolen labor upon stolen land. U.S. ruling class media faithfully follow the script, reporting on the latest Israeli massacres as though they were natural disasters the Palestinians somehow brought upon themselves by refusing to meekly submit to conquest and expulsion by the U.S.-backed state of Israel. For a generation now, it's been obvious to everybody paying attention that a just solution to the problems of Israel-Palestine is only possible under a single small-d democratic state, which represents the rights of all the people living in the territory. But this is a place a party of the U.S. ruling class cannot go. It would mean repudiation of the racist ethnocracy that is today's Israel. And no matter what Democrat grassroots say they want, Democratic Party leaders won't let that happen and have made sure there are no ways to make it happen. Hence the deafening silence from Democrats over the latest wave of massacre in Gaza. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Bruce Dixon. Find us on the web at www.blackagendareport.com and our audio releases each week on SoundCloud, iTunes, and other podcasting apps. In the wake of our being named by the Washington Post in 2015 as the only Black news and commentary source under the presumed influence of the Russians, Google and other corporate social media have gamed and suppressed our visibility on the web. So the only way to be sure you're getting news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left is to visit our website at www.blackagendareport.com and hit the subscribe button so that each week's content from Black Agenda Report arrives directly in your email inbox.
Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier spoke with Mike Africa Jr. of the Philadelphia Move family, whose father and mother, Mike Africa Sr. and Debbie Africa, and other MOVE members have been locked up for 4 decades in the death of a policeman. Supporters of the MOVE 9 have recently been organizing on behalf of Puerto Rican relief, as well as raising money for legal defense. Mike Africa says,
"One thing that we do as MOVE people is we work on projects and programs to try to get people to understand the importance of life. As a result of all of this work that we've been doing, MOVE people have been targeted by the system, city cops and all of that. So our people have been in prison. They've been in prison for 40 years, 9 of them, and we've been fighting to get them out for the last 40 years. So in recent months, what we've been doing is trying to bridge the gap between Spanish people, different races of Black people, different races of people, period. Also, different other types of organizations, too. Black Lives Matter people, mass incarceration abolitionists, prison abolitionists, death penalty abolitionists. And we've been trying to get all of these groups to work together and support and help each other so that we can attain justice with each other. So in the last few months, we've been stepping up our campaign to do this. We've gotten politicians involved. We've gotten community activists and organizers involved, different groups and organizations we've gotten involved that's never been involved before. We've even built other organizations specific to the desires of other people who just wanted to start an organization but wanted to tailor it around their personal preferences. So we're picking up steam. There's more support now than we've ever had before, and it's getting bigger.
And You mentioned these abolitionist groups. I've heard you quote John Africa referring to the courts as slave processing houses. What is the position as regards MOVE on the 13th Amendment and the exception clause there that allows for slavery inside of prisons?
Slavery inside of prisons? How does the 13th Amendment explain all the slavery that exists on the street now? That amendment is an amendment to something that was already amended, and it will be amended again, because as people realize that these amendments are insane, they were written by the same slave masters who wrote the thing that had to be amended. I mean, what is an amendment? It's an add-on. It's an afterthought. It's a correction. And they do these things because they have been forced to change things that they had all messed up. So, damn the 13th Amendment. That thing ain't no more righteous than the thing that they had to amend. This system come up with these laws, and they want people to abide by them. And what people need to understand is just because it's legal, don't make it right.
So, on this question, MOVE also had a strong presence at the most recent court appearance for Mumia Abu-Jamal. What was your takeaway from that court appearance, and what are MOVE's plans moving forward into the August 30th court appearance?
The plan is to keep the pressure on the system. Keep on spreading the word. Keep on exposing the wrongs and the lies in the case. That's the plan. The plan is to keep it going, make others aware of it, reinforce those who are already aware of it, and push the system so that they bend to the will of the people. I mean, that's the only thing that we can do, because that's the only thing that is effective. If the system assigned Mumia's death warrant twice, and if they had their way, he would be executed a long time ago. But we have been, you know, using all the support from the people, and inside the people too. And that's what's been keeping him alive. We ain't going to abandon our strategy that has proven itself to be effective.
Speaking of prison slavery and longstanding injustice, we know that the members of the MOVE 9 have had some parole activity this year. Could you provide us with an update, and what are y'all looking for those out here to do to support those continued efforts?
Same thing with Mumia's case. Keep the pressure on them. Get involved. Write letters to the parole board inquiring. You don't have to call these people demanding the release of anyone. But you can call and just ask what the problem is. You look at the prison records of the people that the prison is holding, and they have done all the things that they said they're supposed to have to do. They've met all the criteria, and they're just being held because they're all MOVE members. It's always been this way. The system has always come at MOVE very hard because they know that the teaching of John Africa exposes the people that actually run this system. And the people that run this system want to stay behind closed doors because they want to keep up enslaving people and making endless money from enslaving people. So as we put out information about who really runs the system, they're really hell-bent on trying to stop us. And we have the solution to destroy the system. And because we have the solution to destroy the system feels threatened by that. But that ain't our fault. The people are going to benefit from destroying the system. Life itself is going to benefit from the system's destruction. And the way to destroy the system is to just stop endorsing it. Stop using it. Get others involved. Unite around and stop endorsing, stop supporting, stop accepting the system. And that is the route to destroying it. People are still too busy trying to get fancy cars and fancy clothes and fancy jobs and fancy houses and all of this stuff. those things, that mentality is what keeps the system going. Because as long as you're circulating excess money and believing in excess, you're keeping the system going. You know, people living beyond their means, making $50,000 a year and spending $100,000 a year. This is what the system creates, excess. And as a result of people wanting all of this excess, the system thrives on it because they're making products. People gain anxiety from these extra products that they have and trying to keep up with the Joneses. So what the system do? They create pharmaceutical drugs to give you so that you calm down. And then you get hooked on drugs, and now you need another drug to combat the other drug. And, you know, that's just how it goes. They say something like 80% of Americans are on some kind of drug. That's the kind of stuff that keeps the system going. Did you know that most of the people who committed those violent acts at those schools, at Sandy Hook, at Parkland, Florida, the Las Vegas shooting, Columbine, all those people who did those things were on drugs, pharmaceutical drugs. That's the kind of stuff that keeps the system going. And instead of addressing that, instead of dealing with that, the system want to have people running around talking about gun laws. But even if you deal with the gun, they've been had gun laws, but people wasn't shooting up schools as much as they are now. They wasn't using those guns to commit violence like they were years ago. In the last 20 years, gun violence in schools alone have tripled. In the last 20 years, it's triple what it was the previous 100 years. This is because people have been driven crazy by the system. And all of these drugs that they're forcing people to take is making the system money. The system don't care if a school gets shot up and 20 people die, 20 kids die. They don't care about that. The reason they don't care about that is because they don't care about the kids. They care about making money. So if 20 kids die, what the gun manufacturers are going to do is they're going to find some kind of way to introduce a new gun. Now, this gun will help you defend yourself, and then they're going to sell more guns. When violent crimes are committed, the gun sales don't go down, they go up. But that's crazy, because if people didn't have guns, they wouldn't be shooting people. But everybody wants guns because they want to feel like they're protecting themselves. But if everybody gets guns and call themselves protecting themselves, then people are going to get shot. Because people are going to shoot people because they feel like they're protecting themselves. But nobody wants to just stop the guns. It's like when people vote. If somebody put two glasses of water on the table and they drop 5 ounces of poison in one, and they drop 3 ounces of poison in the other one, which one are you going to drink? Neither one of them. How about make the person who put it there for you to drink? Give it to them. Let them drink it.
On this topic of the system and the toxicity that it generates, particularly inside of the prisons, could you speak on the current health concerns regarding Delbert Africa?
Yeah, so Delbert is in a situation where the water quality at Dallas Prison is so low that people end up with all kind of problems because of it. Urinary tract infections, they end up with cysts, sores. The water quality is low. My dad was telling me, he's at Graterford, he was telling me that the water at Graterford smells like goose and chlorine. And if you fill up the sink with the water and then drain the sink, there's a residue left in the sink that was in the water. The residue that you see is black specks. And if you wipe it, it smears because there's oil in the water, black, dirty oil. And I asked Delbert about the water there. I said, hey, my dad was telling me about the water at Graterford. What's it like here? He said it's about the same. It ain't much different. You know that you're supposed to drink clear water, clean water. That's going to keep you clean. You know, you are what you eat. You are what you drink. If you're drinking clean water, you want to be clean. But if you're drinking oil-filled water, if drinking goose shit water, if you're drinking chlorine instead of water, then all of those things are going to have a negative effect on you. Well, that's what's happening with Delbert. And it's not just the water. The food, everything that's sweet is super sweet, and everything that's salty is super salty. So it gives you diabetes and high blood pressure. People that didn't have diabetes and they don't even run their family, within 1 year of being incarcerated at Dallas Prison, they end up with diabetes. And that's because of the food quality is so bad. So what's happening with Delbert is he's urinating every hour. He's seeing black spots in his eyes when he know that ain't no black spots really. And this thing is alarming and disturbing to people because these are the same symptoms that Phil had shortly before he died. So we're all on alert. We're all just waiting to see how this thing is going to play out while continually giving Delbert support and encouragement to stay strong.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.